From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Reason to believe that my son was killed by the military.
Where'd you hear that?
I do not think that they would dare do a thing like that unless an American official co-signed a kill order.
Today, a conversation with Joyce Horman, the widow of the American journalist killed 25 years ago in Chile. This, the movie Missing, is based on. Also, with the news that Britain has decided to extradite Pinochet to Spain, we'll go to Madrid to speak to the attorney who is representing 3,000 Chileans. And we'll find out what today is all about, the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Spanish judge seeking the extradition of Chile's Augusto Pinochet formally charged the ex-dictator today with crimes against humanity and asked for a freeze on his assets worldwide. Judge Baltazar Garzon, who ordered Pinochet's arrest in London in mid-October, issued the criminal indictment just one day after Britain's interior minister gave the go-ahead for extradition proceedings against the 83-year-old general. Meanwhile, police in Chile say they arrested 50 people overnight during a violent demonstration outside the British Embassy in Santiago by supporters of former dictator Augusto Pinochet. Around 200 banner-waving protesters set fire to Union Jack flags outside the embassy and blocked traffic. Police used two armored water cannon vehicles to disperse the demonstration when it spilled out on the street, arresting 40 adults and 10 youths. And Chilean leaders denounced Home Secretary Jack Straw's decision immediately withdrawing their ambassador from Britain. This news from Washington. House Judiciary Committee Democrats are blasting Republicans over articles of impeachment they've drawn up against President Clinton. GOP members on the panel drew up four articles yesterday, all stemming from the Monica Lewinsky matter. They include two counts of perjury, one count of obstruction of justice, and one count of abuse of power. Republicans say each amounts to, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors, the impeachment standard established in the Constitution. But committee Democrats have issued a lengthy rebuttal, arguing there's no basis for an impeachment. And a White House spokesman also says there's nothing that warrants impeachment. Instead of impeachment, committee Democrats are offering a draft proposal to censure Clinton. It cites him for reprehensible conduct with a subordinate. That's Monica Lewinsky. This news from Indonesia. 10,000 protesters took to the streets of Jakarta demanding that the former dictator Suharto be put on trial. The students were beaten by officers who blocked 3,000 from marching on the parliament. Student leaders say at least 30 students were injured. It was one of the biggest days of protests since student demonstrations forced Suharto to quit in May after 32 years. And this news from Oklahoma, a Vietnamese immigrant convicted of killing his estranged wife and two young children was executed by injection on his 39th birthday early today. Thuan Anh Nguyen came to America as a teenage Vietnamese refugee in 1975 during the fall of Saigon. His lawyer said that Nguyen's mental health had deteriorated so much he could not understand the death penalty. Nguyen was the 12th person put to death in Oklahoma since 1977 and the 496th nationwide since the death penalty was reinstated that same year. We now turn to Texas, where a well-known case is being considered right now. It is the death penalty case of Joseph Stan Falder. He is slated to die tonight at 6, although we have late news breaking from Texas. We're joined by our producer, Maria Carrion, who has gone to Texas to be at Huntsville, where death row and the death chamber is. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maria.
Thank you, Amy. Last night, a federal court issued a stay of execution for Danny Barber, soon after also staying today's execution of Joseph Stanley Falder. As listeners may remember, Democracy Now! Has carefully been following Falder's case. He's a Canadian citizen sentenced to death for a 1975 murder and whose consular rights were violated when he was arrested. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, as well as the Canadian government and others, have intervened on his behalf. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles has now unwillingly taken the center stage in the battle to save Folder's life. The federal court that stayed both Folder's and Barber's executions, Barber being scheduled for yesterday and last night, did so after their attorneys argued that the board was violating their civil rights by refusing to meet in public and by holding secret votes on clemency. The board has only met once to review a case and has never in history granted clemency. Yesterday, its members denied clemency to Folder in a 17-0 secret vote. Meanwhile, a Canadian delegation headed by former boxing champ Ruben Hurricane Carter yesterday tried to meet with Victor Rodriguez, chairman of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. I am told that Rodriguez got into an argument with one of the members and threatened to call the police. The delegation walked out before introductions were made. Last night, as Danny Barber waited by the death chamber for final word on whether the stay of execution would be lifted before his death warrant expired at midnight, his wife and Folder's niece held vigil outside the wars unit in Huntsville, outside of the death house. The two women comforted each other. I'm told that Barber remarried his wife yesterday. They had been divorced so that she could be eligible for Medicare.
Maria Carriona, I want to thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And tomorrow on Democracy Now! We will go back to Maria Carriona, our producer, now in Texas, there to be witness to whatever happens in Huntsville, which has the largest death row in the country, more than 450 men and women. And we will update you on the Joseph Stanley Folder case and whether or not he is executed tonight at 6 o'clock. Well, Juan, we welcome you to Democracy Now! On this International Human Rights Day.
All right, Amy, and another eventful week around the world and the nation, but you wouldn't know it by looking at Congress, which is still wrapped up in this circus of impeachment proceedings that will end up going nowhere.
Well, yeah, it is very interesting, and we'll certainly be following them, although everything so far that has turned out, at least in the last 2 days, has been rather predictable as President Clinton's lawyers present his defense and the Republicans, even as listening to that defense, drafting the articles of impeachment that they are expected to vote on in the House Judiciary Committee this week, and then that will be sent to the overall House floor. And then the question will be a number of them, including whether this current House can vote for impeachment and then the next Senate put President Clinton on trial. Questions were raised about whether that is actually legal, whether that would cause a constitutional crisis, or whether you need the Senate and House to decide on this in the same term. And there are other issues extremely sobering, like those taking place in Texas, people and Oklahoma and around the country, people being executed as we continue to cover the issue of the death penalty on this 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And speaking of death row, I don't know if you got a chance to see the ABC segment last night on 2020 that Sam Donaldson did on Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yes, I did manage to see that piece of that atrocity of a news coverage.
Well, it seemed to be a very accurate representation of the prosecution case. I thought it was also interesting Sam Donaldson's interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer yesterday. He was quoted as saying, "Everything we looked at compellingly points to the fact that Mumia shot Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner in cold blood and was convicted properly and was sentenced according to the laws of the state of Pennsylvania." Donaldson went on to say in the phone interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer, "As far as I'm concerned, as long as it's on the books, the death sentence has to be carried out." He said the people who support his release don't do so from a position of knowledge. He continued, "They either oppose the death penalty or they're campus rebels or they're African-American activists who believe that a black man was railroaded and will continue to believe it no matter what's presented them." Well, last night, Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney, Len Wineglass, did share his reflections on the ABC 2020 broadcast with Pacifica journalist Robert Knight. During the interview, Wineglass revealed the contents of a letter from ABC producers to the Pennsylvania prison authorities, which reveals something of the 2020 view of Abu-Jamal's case. Wineglass begins with a reaction to Sam Donaldson's comments about the case several hours before the TV broadcast.
And the Philadelphia Inquirer, he's quoted as saying, "Everything we looked at compellingly points to the fact that Mumia shot Faulkner in cold blood and was convicted properly," can you believe that, "and was sentenced accordingly to the laws of the state of Pennsylvania." Then he went on to say, and as far as I'm concerned, as long as it's on the books, the death sentence has to be carried out. I did want to point out one thing that I think is very telling. He talks about a four-month investigation, and this is what the investigation proved. But let me quote from a letter that they wrote to the corrections department when they asked to interview Mumia at the beginning of the investigation, back on June 30th, 1998. This is what they wrote. I'm quoting from the letter. Presently, the only information available to the public regarding Mumia Abu-Jamal is the following, colon, a one-sided HBO documentary. How do they know that? Jamal and his attorneys, many books and recordings. Vast pro-Mumia internet sites. Your typical evening news two-minute pieces featuring celebrity sound bites. This is before they even begin. And then they say, we are working in conjunction with Maureen Faulkner and the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of the Police. We would like to balance this with an interview with Jamal himself. This is before they even start. So you can see their mission. Their mission is to balance what they perceive to be a one-sided documentary and vast pro-Mumia internet sites and celebrity comments on the evening news. You can see the bias even before they start in their first letter to the corrections department dated June 30th, 1998.
That is Len Weinglass, Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney, reading from a letter that 2020 wrote to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections requesting an interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal. In the 2020 report, there's a jump cut in which the widow of the police officer slain in the 1981 incident calls Weinglass a liar. Here is Weinglass's response.
It's interesting that they had the widow calling me a liar because I spoke out in California in Santa Cruz and she appeared. When I finished speaking, I allowed her or her representative, she was there with either a lawyer or an investigator, to rebut anything that I said. And they began to try to rebut it, but they were wrong. And their recitations to facts in the record were wrong. So I had a face-to-face meeting with her and her representative, and the information they were putting out, it turned out, was not supported by the record. I also debated the prosecutor who appeared on camera and giving his version. We've debated twice, once on Larry King and once on Charlie Rose. He won't debate me anymore. And all of these face-to-face meetings where the facts are put into play and both sides are heard from in a fair go-around, they seem to come out second best each time. It's only when it's handled by a producer like Harry Phillips and Sam Donaldson that one side is presented and the other side is sharply curtailed, and it gives the complete impression that the law enforcement side is the accurate one.
Again, that is Len Weinglass, the attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal, responding to the 2020 piece on Mumia Abu-Jamal that aired last night. Juan?
Well, that was an obvious hit job by Sam Donaldson, and I mean, I was amazed at the way that he would ask a question of Len Weinglass and only edit in the that answer that most benefited making Weinglass look like he didn't know what he was talking about. And it's no surprise the way ABC has been going of late under the Disney ownership.
Well, Juan, I think there was one positive thing to come out of last night's segment on Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that was at the end of the piece, Sam Donaldson came on and said that the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections said that they couldn't interview Mumia Abu-Jamal. But he did go on to say that Mumia Abu-Jamal has agreed to an interview but won't do it until the ABC strike is over. I think that's the first time I've heard ABC talking about the strike that's going outside of its headquarters of NABET workers. So something positive came out of that. Again, that discussion with Len Weinglass was recorded by Pacifica WBAI reporter Robert Knight. And talking about human rights, we now turn to the major issue at hand, which is the British decision yesterday that was announced by Jack Straw, the Home Secretary, the British decision to extradite Augusto Pinochet to Spain. Now, this will go to the courts because Pinochet will appeal it. And we will certainly follow this as he remains in Britain as he appeals this. But we're joined right now by the lawyer in Madrid representing over 3,000 victims of the Pinochet regime and their family members. He's also the former advisor to the democratically elected Salvador Allende in Chile, who was overthrown by Pinochet. Juan Garces is with us from Madrid. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan Garces. Well, I would ask you to speak up as loud as you can, but what was your reaction yesterday when you heard the decision of the British government to go ahead with the extradition?
I think that this is a positive signal of cooperation.
As loud as you can speak, please.
Yes. This is a positive signal of cooperation among European governments for prosecuting the most difficult crime to prosecute, that is, massive killings and crimes against humanity. In my opinion, only through an effective international cooperation can be prevented crimes of this kind. And if you want to deter future massive killings, now you need to fight impunity.
Juan Garces, in the reports that we're getting here, they are talking about a process that could take as long as a year to possibly extradite General Pinochet from England. Could you comment on that and what you see as the next steps in this process?
Yes. With yesterday's decision from the Home Office, the extradition proceedings will begin in the British tribunal that has competence for extradition. How long that will take, it depends on the different appeals that can be filed by the parties in the proceedings, and that can take 3 months, between 3 months and 1 year and a half.
And can you explain what Judge Baltazar Garzon did yesterday, the Spanish judge seeking the extradition of Pinochet, formally charging the ex-dictator today with crimes against humanity and asking for a freeze on his assets worldwide?
Well, we have just been notified today of Pinochet indictment by the Spanish judge. He's charged of crimes of genocide, terrorism, and torture. That is right. I can confirm you this information.
We also wanted to get your personal reaction because we've spoken with you before, but not talked about your own personal involvement in the Chile case, having been very close to Salvador Allende, who died in the palace when the Pinochet regime took power in the coup in 1973. In fact, you were in the palace that morning. Is that right?
Yes, I was there. I am one of the survivors in this attack. Many others assistants to the president were arrested and then tortured, and now they are disappeared.
And how did you manage to get out from that situation?
Well, I am a Spaniard, and the Spanish government sent a special plane to Santiago, and I came back to Europe in 10 days later in this plane.
We're going to come back to Juan Garces in just a minute, and we're also going to be joined by Saul Landau, who wrote the book about Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt, who were killed in a car bomb by the Pinochet regime, not in Chile, but in the United States. And then we're going to hear from Joyce Horman, the widow of Charles Horman, the American journalist who was killed by the Pinochet regime as it rose to power. He was killed in the Santiago Stadium. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, this all on this day, International Human Rights Day, which is the 50th anniversary of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. Stay with us.
Tyrants decline. The year 1979. From Uganda to Nicaragua, it's bombs and bullets all the time. So they corrupt, so they vile. So it's coup after coup all
is a wanted man. Shall be ran, fighting hard to survive. He too is wanted, dead or alive.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests, Juan Garces, the judge, or rather the lawyer in Madrid, Spain, who is representing thousands of cases of Chileans tortured or killed under the Pinochet regime. And now joining us from California, Saul Landau. Saul Landau, senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of a number of books, including Murder on Embassy Row, about the assassination of former Chilean Foreign Minister Orlando Letelier, as well as Ronnie Moffitt, another person who worked at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Saul Landau was very close to them both. They were his colleagues at the Institute. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Saul.
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
Good morning. Tell us your reaction to yesterday's decision. And I do want to get into at this point as well the Condor Plan, which is Pinochet's plan not only in Chile and what he did to Chileans there, but in throughout South America.
Well, my reaction to yesterday's decision by British Minister Straw was, you know, it certainly beats the proverbial poke in the eye with a sharp stick. I was delighted. And I think this will mean that this case is now going to dangle in the British court system for quite a while. And as a result, I think, thanks to my colleague Juan Garces and other people who have worked on this, much more information is going to be made available to the world that shows what this international serial killer named Pinochet was really doing. I think also, you know, we'll have evidence that he was manufacturing weapons of mass destruction. This also will come out. And tyrants everywhere are going to be, how should I say it, somewhat worried about travel plans.
Well, Saul Landau, tell us about Operation Condor, which involved not just Pinochet, obviously, but many of the worst tyrants in modern Latin American history.
Well, Condor was a six-nation conspiracy. Try to picture this. The intelligence agencies hyphen secret police of Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, and for a short time Bolivia all came together with a computer to tie their communications links for the purpose of monitoring each other's dissidents in other countries. In other words, a Argentine dissident living in Uruguay would be surveilled by the political police of that country and vice versa. That was the first stage. So they kept track on each other's dissidents and then sent the reports in on this computer. The second stage of Condor was when a dissident was judged to be too troublesome. Plans were made to eliminate or assassinate him. And this was done by Condor agents, in other words, a Chilean exile in Argentina, would be eliminated by a joint operation of Chilean and Argentine secret police. This was the case, in fact, with General Carlos Prats, the former Chilean chief of staff, whom, by the way, Pinochet replaced. He was living in Argentina in exile with his wife. Michael Townley, an American-born, indeed a U.S. citizen, working for the Chilean secret police, visited Buenos Aires, Argentina. He met with members of Milicia, which was ultra-right-wing, but now with government ties by the fall of 1974. Townley instructed them on making the bomb. They placed the bomb in General Prats' car or under his car, and as he entered his garage one night, the militia members detonated the bomb and blew the general and his wife nine stories high. Now, that was the second stage of Condor, but there was an even more deadly third stage, and this involves killing opponents outside of the member countries, and this began... this operation began in 1974-75 with several unsuccessful attempts. Townley recounts some of these. He was later taken prisoner by the FBI. And he told one of the FBI agents about some of his plans that didn't succeed. That was the plan to kill the entire leadership of the Allende Coalition in exile. They were meeting in Mexico. Luckily, Townley didn't get that one together in time. He was supposed to kill Carlos Altamirano, exiled head of the Socialist Party in Spain, and another leader in Portugal. The CIA foiled these particular coups. But finally, the hit that brought Condor to the attention of the American public occurred in Washington, D.C., and that was the assassination of Orlando Letelier, during which Ronnie Moffitt also died. It was a car bombing. And that took place, I mean, I think people might be interested to understand how this actually worked. So picture back in the summer of 1976, in June, when Michael Townley, the ubiquitous killer, who used to think of himself as Dina's jackal — Dina was the Chilean secret police intelligence operation under Pinochet — Townley, along with a fellow officer, Armando Fernandez Larios, traveled from Chile to Paraguay, to Asunción, the capital of Paraguay. They have false names on false Chilean passports. They get to Paraguay, and these passports are exchanged, and they now have official Paraguayan passports under false names, of course, and a letter from President Stroessner's office — he was the then dictator of Paraguay — to the U.S. ambassador, saying, "President Stroessner specifically requests that you grant visas to these two officials." And, he adds, they had a meeting with Deputy Director of the CIA, General Vernon Walters. Now, these two guys then proceed to the United States Consulate in Asunción, present their applications and their false Paraguayan passports. And here comes the, how should we say it, the fly in the ointment, the flaw in the plan, what led to the paper trail that allowed the FBI ultimately to break the Letelier case. The Consul General, a civil servant in the State Department, reads the applications, looks at these two guys, and decides that they are lying, that their applications are false, and tells the ambassador, because he has already a note, "Treat these guys with special respect. They come from a letter from the Paraguayan president's office." And he says, "I'm going to deny them the visas." And the ambassador says, "Why?" He says, "They're lying on their application. This guy's 6'3" tall with blue eyes and says he was born in a Guarani village where nobody's over 5 feet tall. That's among the lies." Well, the ambassador says, "I'm ordering you to give them the visas. We owe this to the president." Meanwhile, this delay is causing problems in the operation. So President Stroessner's aide comes to the U.S. ambassador and says, "Look, this is a request that came from General Pinochet, straight to General Stroessner, President Stroessner." He was also a general. The ambassador says, "Okay, I will get them the visas." And he writes a written order to the consul general to give these two agents visas. The agents, Michael Townley and Fernandez Larios, then are given official U.S. visas for the purpose of visiting with General Vernon Walters. That's the alleged purpose.
So, Lando, if I can interrupt you for 1 second.
Sure.
I'd like to get Juan Garces back in the conversation, because we have him on phone from Spain. I'd like to ask you, Juan Garces, are you there?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you, in terms of Operation Condor, how many of the clients that you represent were victimized by this international operation, not just the that part of it that obviously directly involved Pinochet?
Well, probably more than 100 cases, people that were arrested in Argentina and then disappeared in Chile and vice versa. There are dozens and dozens of people, and also between Uruguay and Chile and Uruguay and Argentina. There are hundreds of cases.
And is there any possibility that the judicial proceedings now going on in Spain could be expanded beyond Pinochet to some of these some of the individuals involved in the overall Condor conspiracy?
Yes, because originally, when this case was opened in Spain in 1996, there were two different independent cases: one concerning crimes committed in Argentina, and the second one, crimes committed by Pinochet in Chile and other countries. Now, both cases are together in the same court, and the investigation is going ahead, combining the two cases, original different cases. So the investigation is covering several countries.
Juan Garces, I want to thank you for joining us from Madrid. I know you do have to go. And Saul, we do have to wrap up because we're going to Joyce Horman next, the widow of Charles Horman, the U.S. journalist killed as Pinochet rose to power along with so many others in the Santiago Stadium in September of 1973. But I wanted to get to the memo that you've gotten, that this information that's come out under various means, including the Freedom of Information Act, and your involvement in the whole case of Letelier?
Well, as I was saying, the paper trail started here, and it brings in the CIA. It brings in the U.S. government. And it literally leaves the question still unanswered in this country about what role was played by U.S. intelligence in not just in the coup itself or setting up the coup in Chile in 1973, but in the post-coup era, in cooperating with operations like Condor, and cooperating with General Pinochet's terror campaign. The United States government hasn't got clean hands, I will say. That's a bit of an understatement. And the Condor operation really reveals the extent to which I think that they were collaborating or cooperating. Not that U.S. officials did the killings or even said that you can kill in the United States or elsewhere, but the fact that the CIA provided the computer for Condor and that they knew about the two killings in Portugal and Spain and or planned killings and stopped them. So the United States government's involved. And if people want a clue as to why some officials are a little bit nervous about the Pinochet case going forward, I think here you would find the reason. You have international serial killing being planned out of Chile. This is international terrorism at its highest. Now, we got this document from the FBI. It was an FBI agent who came across the Condor operation. The CIA knew about it, but they didn't tell the FBI. And this particular document, which lists these three phases of Condor, is certain to be introduced in the trial or in the hearings that now go on in England. Finally, there's one other point, and this will be the culpability of Pinochet himself. There's no doubt, and the American, this is another document that has yet to be declassified that we were lucky enough to see, and I can't tell you how, but it's a Defense Intelligence Agency document that said it is inconceivable that these killings could have been taken place without the express authorization of President Pinochet. He was referring to the Prats killing, to the shooting of Bernardo Leighton in Rome, and to the Letelier assassination in Washington. Inconceivable. And then it describes the rigid Prussian hierarchical nature of the command structure of the Chilean military. That is, no decision could conceivably be made of any importance without the express authorization of the commander-in-chief. And the head of the secret police, Colonel Contreras at the time, reported only to General Pinochet, to no one else. So there's no question in the mind of the United States intelligence agencies, and they have yet to release this document to the Spanish judge, by the way, that General Pinochet was the responsible authority for all of this international serial killing that was going on.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Saul Landau, for joining us and for your work on Chile. Again, Saul Landau, who co-authored the book Murder on Embassy Row, Institute for Policy Studies fellow, who actually hired Orlando Letelier, is that right, to succeed you at the Institute for Policy Studies?
Yes, Amy, it's assassination on Embassy Row.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I did. I hired Letelier, was exiled in Venezuela shortly after his release from the concentration camp where Pinochet had put him without charges. He was in Caracas. I called him on the telephone, asked him if he wanted a job in Washington. He came up and decided he wanted the job, and essentially working at that job cost him his life.
Well, Saul Landau, thanks for being with us. Saul Landau, who is the chair at California State Polytechnic of the Interdisciplinary Applied Knowledge Department and author of Assassination on Embassy Row. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we turn now to Joyce Horman. Among the thousands of victims of the regime of Augusta Pinochet, there were at least three American citizens killed. Ronnie Moffitt was a research assistant to Orlando Letelier, the former foreign minister of Chile. She and Letelier were blown up in Washington, D.C. by Pinochet's secret police, as you've just heard. There were also two Americans who were executed by the Chilean military days after the 1973 coup, a U.S. journalist named Charles Horman and his friend Frank Tarugi. For the last 25 years, Charles Horman's wife, Joyce Horman, has been pressing the U.S. government to release its documents associated with the Pinochet regime. She's been pursuing a federal lawsuit accusing former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and 11 other American officials of contributing to her husband's wrongful death. The lawsuit was dismissed in 1982 because the information was classified top secret. Joyce Horman came to our studios yesterday afternoon, just after she heard the news of the British government saying that, yes, Augusto Pinochet could be extradited to Chile. And we began by talking about her reaction.
It's absolutely thrilling to hear about the second huge watermark that the British have delivered to us just in time for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 50th anniversary today. It is a spectacular and wonderful thing that's happened.
In what way does this impact on the case of your husband? Actually, I'd like to go back to 1973, if you wouldn't mind, and what you both were doing in Chile.
Well, as you mentioned, my husband Charles was a journalist, and he was ferociously interested in what was happening in Chile at the time. We were doing different things. He was doing some study and some writing and also scripting a documentary about Chile. And I've been in software for a long time. I was doing a little bit of that, but I was also exploring animation and some of my artistic side. So we were getting to know the country for a little over a year before the coup happened.
And what happened?
Well, a friend of ours had come down just a few days before the coup, and I was encouraging her to actually get the tourist part over with and perhaps leave, because there was increasing tension at that time. So I had taken her to the mountains for a day or so, and Charles took her to the coast, and they were caught there in the coup. So I was in Santiago alone during the first week, and the strafing of the Moneda, the 24-hour curfew, the violence that you could hear all over the city, and the radio saying that you should report any neighbors with the last names of Steinberg or Berg were extremely terrifying.
What do you mean with the last names of Steinberg?
Stein or Berg. I mean, it was an incredible, immediately oppressive regime, looking for foreigners, looking for denunciations of neighbors, looking for any excuse, really, to take someone out of their home and put them into the national stadium. It was with great relief when Charles and our friend Terry came back from Viña del Mar, and it was that day that I heard Charles tell that he and Terry had encountered some U.S. military personnel in Viña who seemed very excited and prideful of the success of the coup. And he understood immediately the political compromise that that represented for the United States. And so he planned on the next day to help Terry arrange for some exit from Chile and for ourselves as well. He was going to inquire. And I planned to go and check on some friends to be sure that they were okay after a week of intense violence in the streets. That night, I was unable to get back to the house. And when in the morning the curfew was lifted, as it had been temporarily the day before, I made my way back to the house and found it completely torn apart. And although I did not immediately know that Charles had been taken, I soon learned from the neighbors that, in fact, he had been taken by Chilean military personnel, and their truck had driven directly to the National Soccer Stadium. So at that point, I went to look for help to try and find him and to get help that we might, after finding him, leave the country. And I found it very difficult, and I found the Americans fairly unhelpful. And I called Charles's father in New York. And luckily, he was a very courageous man and came down to Santiago from New York City, and we looked for Charles together. And that's really the basis of the movie Missing, is that search.
That movie, one of the things that stuck in my mind was Charles's father and his original faith in the U.S. government and what happened to him when the two of you were dealing with the U.S. government in Chile during the coup. Was that accurate?
It was very accurate, and I think that it was his stalwartness in that belief that really let us get at a certain amount of information while we were down there. I mean, he expected full cooperation, and when he didn't get it, he was bound and determined to find some other way to get cooperation in his search for his son.
Well, Joyce Harmon, we're going to break, and when we come back, we're going to hear that excerpt of the movie where Ed Horman, Charles's father, confronts the U.S. ambassador to Chile. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we speak with the widow of the U.S. journalist killed when Pinochet rose to power in 1973 in Chile. Stay with us.
Strikes, demonstrations, and wars. Injustice is always the cause. Politicians turn too soon from poor people into tycoons. Corruption must bring horrors. South African Foster resign in disgrace. Mozoriwa take where Ian Smith plays. The Uganda devil was his illegal cat's prattle, beaten up and chased. What a waste. Gary is a wanted man. Patrick John is a wanted man. The Shah of Iran, fighting hard to survive. He too is wanted, dead or alive.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with Joyce Horman on this day after the British government did clear the way for the extradition of the former Chilean dictator, Augusto Pinochet, to be sent to Spain. Joyce Horman, we're now going to turn to that part in Missing where your father-in-law, where Ed Horman, the father of Charles Horman, the U.S. journalist killed by the Pinochet regime when it rose to power. It was just after he found out what actually happened to his son, yet the U.S. ambassador to Chile was telling him something else. And Ed Horman was played by Jack Lemmon.
Ed, the ambassador is waiting for you in the ballroom.
We've been trying to reach you all morning. I think we may have some good news for you.
Oh, what would that be? That my son was executed in the stadium 3 days after his arrest.
Wait, who told you that?
Ed, wait a second. Oh, good, Consul, you found him.
Mr. Horman has some new information of his own, Mr. Ambassador, and I'll check it out right away.
I have reason to believe that my son was killed by the military.
Where'd you hear that?
I do not think that they would dare do a thing like that unless an American official co-signed a kill order.
Don't you think that's a hell of a statement, especially considering we're here to protect American citizens?
Mr. Horman, this mission has done everything humanly possible to locate your son.
I think you knew he was dead from the start.
If we knew, why wouldn't we tell you?
I don't know that, but I'm going to find out.
Why would we want him dead?
Probably because he knew of our involvement in the coup.
We're not involved, Mr. Horman. Our position has been completely neutral.
That is a bald-faced lie. How can you say a thing like that when you have army colonels, you have naval engineers, they're all over Viña del Mar?
Please, sit down. Look, it's very obvious that you're harboring some misconception regarding our role here.
What is your role here, besides endorsing a regime that murders thousands of human beings?
Let's level with each other, sir. If you hadn't been personally involved in this unfortunate incident, You'd be sitting at home, complacent, and more or less oblivious to all of this. This mission is pledged to protect American interests. Our interests, Mr. Hammond.
Well, they're not mine.
There are over 3,000 U.S. firms doing business down here, and those are American interests. In other words, your interests. I'm concerned with the preservation of a way of life.
And a damn good one.
Maybe that's why there's nobody out there.
You can't have it both ways.
I don't know what happened to your kid, Ed. But I understand he was a bit of a snoop. He poked his nose around in a lot of dangerous places where he really didn't belong. Now, suppose I went up to your town, New York, and I started messing around with the mafia. I wind up dead in the East River. And my wife, or my father, complained to the police because they didn't protect me. They really wouldn't have much of a case, would they? You play with fire.
How did you get information, and how did you find out what happened to your husband, Charles Horman?
Well, it was actually Ford Foundation personnel who finally told Ed that they had learned from very authentic sources that Charles had been killed in the stadium by the Chileans, that he'd been executed there. And it was after Edmund brought that story to the consul and the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador, that the Chileans finally admitted that they'd found a body that they believed to be Charles, and they asked for his dental records to confirm that. And it was after that that the U.S. confirmed that Charles had been killed. But no one ever confirmed that he was killed in the stadium at that time. To this day, I believe the U.S. knew a lot more about Charles and when things happened to him than they ever shared with us.
Are you also suggesting from the previous description of Charles finding these U.S. soldiers, Marines, did you say?
Well, military personnel.
Military personnel being very excited and proud about what was happening, that there was U.S. military personnel there during the coup?
Certainly Charles's exposure to them convinced Charles that there had been a great deal of cooperation and far beyond what was known commonly at that time about U.S. presence in Chile. Charles thought that their cover was compromised by what he had seen in Viña del Mar.
We're talking to Joyce Horman, whose husband was slain during the 1973 coup in Chile when Pinochet rose to power. The latest news, the British government says that Pinochet can be extradited to Spain, where lawyers want to try him for thousands of cases involving crimes against humanity and war crimes. Is your case, the case of Charles, included in those cases in Spain?
I have spoken to the Spanish judges that mounted this case, and we certainly would agree to testify if that is requested of us.
What has been the reaction of the U.S. government? First of all, you filed a lawsuit. Who did you sue? And then we'll find out if the U.S. government has what the U.S. government's reaction has been over the last two decades.
It was in the late 70s that we sued Kissinger et al. For information. Actually, we sued them for wrongful death on Charles Horman. And
Henry Kissinger, at the time, National Security Advisor for
he had just,
Nixon.
You know, it was just after, I think it was just the week after the coup that he was being confirmed as Secretary of State. So we were suing Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State and others in the State Department for wrongful death and for information concerning the death of Charles Horman.
Joyce Horman has been our guest, the widow of Charles Horman, the U.S. journalist killed in Chile, along with so many other thousands of Chileans as Pinochet rose to power in 1973. In just a minute, we're going to find out what the
today is all about, International Human Rights Day, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. But we thought we'd go out of this segment with a little more from Missing. This is the end of the movie where Ed Horman and Joyce Horman, who is played by Sissy Spacek, are leaving the country. They've just been told that Charles Horman's body will be sent to them in the next few days, and they're walking along the airport, and Ed Horman is extremely angry as he's being escorted by members of the U.S. Embassy in Chile, and he talks to them.
Listen, Mr. Horman, I wish there was something we could say or do.
Well, there's something I'm going to do. I'm going to sue you, Phil, and Towler, and the ambassador, and everybody who let that boy die. We're going to make it so hot for you, you'll wish you were stationed in the Antarctic.
Well, I guess that's your privilege.
No, that's my right. I just thank God that we live in a country where we can still put people like you in jail.
You're listening to Democracy Now!
Ed Horman filed suit charging 11 government officials, including Henry A. Kissinger, with complicity and negligence in the death of his son. The body was not returned home until 7 months later, making an accurate autopsy impossible. After years of litigation, the information necessary to prove or disprove complicity remained classified as secrets of state. The suit was dismissed.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we thought we'd end today's show by finding out just what this day is all about, International Human Rights Day, which today is the 50th anniversary of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We're joined by Professor of Law Stephanie Farrior, who is at Pennsylvania State University, the Dickinson School of Law.
Professor Farrior, could you tell us briefly what is the Declaration of Human Rights and what exactly does it cover?
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was a resolution adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1948 that declares that there are certain rights that all people throughout the world hold, and it covers several categories of rights. It covers personal rights, such as freedom of expression, religion, freedom from torture and slavery. It covers procedural rights, such as safeguards for people who are accused of committing crimes. It covers economic and social rights, including the right to employment, social security, and the right to enjoy certain minimum standards of economic well-being. And it covers political rights, such as right to citizenship and the right to participate in one's own government.
And does it also cover linguistic rights? Because I know that in the United States has often been an issue. No U.S. court recognizes linguistic rights.
The right to freedom from discrimination permeates every article, every provision in the Universal Declaration, and that includes discrimination on the basis of language.
Who wrote the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Well, it was the product of a committee that was appointed by the UN Economic and Social Council. The idea for this document really came during the drafting of the charter that created the United Nations in 1945. When the government delegations were drafting the charter, they were persuaded by representatives of a number of non-governmental organizations to make one of the main purposes of the UN promotion of respect for human rights. So then there was the question of defining what those human rights are. So the Economic and Social Council of the UN established a commission on human rights and made its first priority the drafting of an international bill of rights, and the first chair of that committee, a commission, was Eleanor Roosevelt. So what they did was to gather input from governments and from philosophers and others on what the content of the declaration should be. they got the relevant rights provisions that in existing constitutions from almost all of the states that made up the United Nations. They had draft proposals from such countries as Chile, Cuba, India, Panama, the U.S. And they went through that, and on the basis of that input and subsequent discussion, came up with a draft which Eleanor Roosevelt actually is recognized for helping achieve consensus on. And that went to the floor of the UN General Assembly 50 years ago today, and it was adopted without any dissenting vote.
And how is it enforced? Are there any countries that actually have incorporated it into their national legal systems?
Yes, the declaration is just that. It's not a binding treaty. It is just that, a declaration that all human beings have certain rights. But its impact has been quite significant. And a number of constitutions around the world make explicit reference to the Universal Declaration, saying and incorporating it into their terms. National courts, the Supreme Courts of many states, many nations, have again made explicit reference to it and relied on the Universal Declaration in reaching some of their decisions. Legislatures of many nations have made explicit reference to the Universal Declaration in developing their own internal law.
I know today in Paris, many people are gathered from around the world, human rights activists, to honor this day. They're gathered at the place in Paris where it was formally written and adopted, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But end on this note, Professor Farrier, what does it mean to have countries sign on to a Universal Declaration of Human Rights that are severe human rights violators? And finally, you have the U.S. supporting it, and yet the U.S. opposes an international criminal court that supposedly would enforce this kind of standard.
It is significant that even those states that may violate some of the rights in the Declaration publicly declare support for it. And in fact, it is the fact that it is set a universal standard for all nations that has been used by such organizations as Amnesty International to say, you have committed to this, states, and now it's time to enforce and implement it. With respect to the International Criminal Court, again, this is, I'd like to make reference to something that happened 50 years ago yesterday, and that was the adoption by the United Nations of the Convention Against Genocide. One of the things that the Permanent International Criminal Court will finally be able to achieve is to provide an international forum to try these crimes.
Well, Stephanie Farrier, thank you very much for joining us, Professor of Law at the Dickinson School of Law at Pennsylvania State University, on this 50th anniversary of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives. 1-800-735-0230 is our number. That's 1-800-735-0230. The music in the background, the theme music from the movie Missing, of which we've played excerpts throughout the show based on the story of Charles Horman, the U.S. journalist killed along with so many thousands of Chileans by the Pinochet regime. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. Tomorrow, we go down to Texas, to death row. We'll be joined by our producer, Maria Carrion, as well as Ray Hill, prison rights advocate. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our producer, Jeremy Scahill, and Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland, our technical director, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
3 seconds over.